Welcome to Limitless, the Blind Beginnings podcast where we discuss tips, tricks, and current topics related to all things in the blind and partially sighted community. Now, it is my pleasure to introduce the founder of Blind Beginnings and your host, Sean Marcellet, and whatever co-host is on this week. Now, here's your host, Sean.
I'm your host, Sean Marcellet. You're listening to Limitless, the Blind Beginnings podcast. I'm super excited about today's topic because it's one that's been pretty important to me. Today, we're going to be talking about Braille and all things Braille. And we have an awesome guest as well. And Ginny is our co-host today. Ginny, you've been using Braille for a long time, correct?
Hello. And yes, I have. I've been using it since about grade two.
Okay. And why do you think this is an important topic?
Because I think that as our world has evolved and keeps evolving and includes more technology, that Braille is becoming an important topic to discuss because people are seeing it as something that maybe isn't as necessary anymore. And I just don't think that is true in my personal opinion. So I want to have a whole discussion around it.
I would agree. I think Braille is always going to be important. And I think our guest feels that way too. Do you want to introduce our guest?
Sure. So today with us, we have the wonderful Adam Wilton. So Adam, welcome.
Hi, I'm so delighted to be here. Big fan of the show, have to say. Delighted to get an invite to be on it. Hi, my name is Adam Wilton. I'm the manager of the Provincial Resource Center for the Visually Impaired, located in Vancouver, British Columbia. We're a provincial outreach program serving students kindergarten through grade 12, all across the province. And so we are primarily tasked with material resource needs. And so we provide books in large print format, in Braille format, one of the reasons I'm here. And we also provide outreach support across the province to teachers of students with visual impairments working directly with students in their local schools. And I should tell you, my background is as a teacher of students with visual impairments. I've been in the field for, wow, it's been a while since I've counted the number of years, close to 14 years. And I'm also an orientation and mobility specialist, and I've been working in this administrative role for about 5 years now.
Wow.
So what is Braille? I feel like you're the expert, Adam. Well, how would you describe it?
I first just have to give a caveat for all of your listeners. I am not a Braille user. I read print. I identify as a typically sighted individual. But I am a big supporter of Braille, but specifically what it means for our students who are blind or visually impaired. So back to your question, what is Braille? Well, Braille is a tactile writing system. It is an elegant code that provides individuals who are blind or visually impaired with tactile access to the written word. And so some refer to it as a code. I've heard it referred to as a writing system, and I prefer that because I think it better conveys the kind of beautiful complexities and the wonderful simplicities, which I know sounds like a contradiction, but...
there is also a bit of a misconception that it's another language.
I was just going to say that.
Yeah, mm-hmm. Braille is not another language in the same way that, let's say, American Sign Language would be. Braille does not have its own syntax. It does not have its own grammar. It is another way of representing the language in question. So for example, in the English-speaking world, we use the Unified English Braille Code. UEB, for short, is another way of representing the English language in the same way that the print alphabet represents the English language in its written form.
So a question I often get is there Braille in other languages then?
Absolutely. Absolutely. I couldn't unfortunately give you a stat right off the top of my head. And that's not necessarily because I don't kind of keep track of these things, but because there are new Braille codes being written and devised even today. Languages that maybe had not had a Braille code or a system developed are getting that. And so, you know, within the last decade, the Navajo language in the US had a Braille code devised for it. So these things are always changing. And that just shows the continued growth and relevance of Braille across the world.
Now that some of our listeners are better able to understand what Braille is, what places is it typical for people to see Braille when they're out and about in the general public?
It's a great question. So many building codes require Braille signage as part of accessibility guidelines. And so you'll often find Braille in the built environment, usually on signage, either signage directing an individual or signage that says, you know, what room number it is, or the, you know, whether it's a storage room or a washroom is usually quite common as well, because when we're kind of searching for things in the built environment, we're almost universally searching for the washroom at one point or another. And so you'll often find Braille there. Another really common place in the built environment is in elevators. In fact, I think it would be challenging to find an elevator that doesn't have at least some sort of Braille labeling on its buttons.
Okay, so back to the school system. How do kids that are blind learn Braille? When do they learn Braille? How does that? Where do we start, or where do you start?
Ooh, good boy! I tell you, great questions. Where we start with Braille actually depends on what we know of the student and what we know of their sensory profile and what we know about them as a learner. And so to say that we start at one time or another with Braille, there's no kind of one line answer for that. Really what we're looking to do is the Qualified Teacher of Students with Visual Impairments, or TVI, which is a specialist educator, who, at least in our context here in British Columbia, works in inclusive settings. This teacher would help to coordinate a process called learning media assessment. And learning media assessment is a systematic process through which we assess the goodness of fit of one particular medium over the other. And sometimes a combination of those two. You know, we have many students in the province who read both print and Braille. But we'd always make sure that the decision to teach Braille to a student was based on evidence, you know, what we know about the student, what we know about how they gather information and about how they interact with their world. So for some students, it can be Braille can start as early as preschool. For some students, it can start after, let's say, a change in their vision in adolescence or earlier. For some people, they might not learn Braille until adulthood. So it depends, again, on the sensory profile, but also on how that individual is gathering information about from the environment, and also what their goals are.
Right. So especially in a case of a child that has limited vision or low vision, this is a complicated question.
Absolutely. And you know what? It's one of our most important questions. What I sometimes say to teachers who are new to our field is that, you know, there is no quick answer here, nor should there be, because this is one of the most important decisions we can make with our students who are blind or visually impaired that will impact, you know, for years and years to come.
Do you think that students who are in maybe high school or middle school and abruptly lose their vision, do you think that sometimes they are lumped into an audio learner category because they're already going through so much change? Or because that one is also like a complicated.
Mm-hmm. that's a complicated one with no kind of, again, one line answer. In my mind, it would all depend on those factors that I mentioned. What's the student's profile? What are their goals? What are their learning goals? How are they gathering information now? And this would all be information that we would collect as educators to inform a decision-making process that involved not only teachers and parents, but also the student themselves.
That's a really good point, though. Just because you're blind doesn't mean you are an auditory learner. And yeah. I know there are lots of people who are blind who need to touch it. They need the Braille, right? It's sort of like a visual learner needs to see it to really take it in. Sometimes people who are blind need to see it how we see it, right?
Right. And related to that, Sean, you know, you might have someone whose goal is to work or study in a field where access to the structure of written language is very important to them. And so it might not be someone who can listen to everything. This mm-hmm. person, they might need access to, you know, tactile graphics, to the structure of language, like for example, someone who's reading poetry, that the formatting can sometimes be very important. Mm-hmm. It really depends on the profile of the individual.
I think that's a good point, because I am currently in a creative writing degree and have been offered no Braille simply because it takes up too much space and time to make. Mm-hmm. And I definitely can empathize with that, because reading poetry or giving feedback to another student is extremely challenging with just audio.
Right. And that's actually one of the main reasons, and I don't want to get ahead, because I suspect this question may come later, but when we're talking about the continued relevance and importance of Braille, you know, there is no alternative, you know, to giving access to written language. And when I say written language, I mean in a general sense.
I want to talk about how kids learn Braille in school. I think, you know, a lot of our listeners may not even know that they're not going to schools for the blind for the most part, and how that process works.
Well, I'll start by saying learning to read Braille and learning to read print have far more in common than they do differences. I think that's really important to recognize, because for people who don't know Braille or they don't understand tactile reading, they might think that, well, you know, reading with one's eyes and reading with one's fingers must be an entirely different process. But there's actually a lot more in common. And so learning to read Braille is actually just embedded in the student's literacy programming. You know, that we're sharing stories, we're writing stories, we're experimenting with writing different types, you know, lists, we're writing poems, we're writing letters to our dogs, we're, you know, writing all kinds of things, and reading as well, reading different types of texts. And, you know, those core component skills of reading need to be in place, regardless of whether you're reading print or Braille.
So what comes first, teaching to read or teaching Braille? I mean, you can't really learn to read mm-hmm. if you don't know the Braille, right?
Well, that's a great question. And I think that it mostly, in my experience, they come hand in hand, right? So and one motivates the other. You know, the more you want to read, the more you're going to work on your Braille skills. And the better your Braille skills are, the easier it's going to be to read.
So the teacher of the visually impaired then is probably in most cases teaching the child to read if they're learning Braille sort of along yes. with their sighted peers.
In partnership with the classroom teacher, absolutely. But in the case of a student who is learning to read Braille, the teacher of students with visual impairments is a major motivator of literacy development. Yeah,
hey, absolutely. That's a really important role.
Yeah, it absolutely is. It's one that we take very, very seriously and have a lot of fun with too.
Ginny, what was your experience like learning Braille?
I think mine was quite different. I didn't learn Braille until grade 2, and I don't remember having really an assessment done. It was just, oh, you have this cool machine, and you're going to start learning, you know, the letters and things like that. And then I didn't start learning my contractions until like grade 4, which I felt like was very delayed. Personally, I did have, you know, when the other kids were learning their print letters, I was sitting down doing my Braille letters. When the other kids were doing their silent reading, you know, I was expected to pull out a Braille book.
Do you remember being introduced to Braille, like, before you started learning it? Like, Braille labels or Braille books or anything with Braille?
No, which was the funny part. I actually got, I did get a pot, like, this book with where the Braille was pretty big. I think that was the only thing I really got at the beginning. But I never had, like, you know, look, these are, like, labels or these are, you know, Braille Legos or Braille things like that, you know, that a child might get. Mm. I never had that, which I think was kind of sad.
Well, yeah, I mean, sighted kids see letters on signs and everywhere in their world before they learn to read, right?
Yeah, exactly. And I think that's where it also became much more challenging for me was taking spelling tests, because I was not and am not a good speller, because yes, although I was, you know, told to read, I was never encouraged to read outside of school. It was, you know, here's your silent reading book, but, you know, there wasn't this, you know, oh, everyone's going to the library, do you want to pick a book? You know, I went to the library with the kids and I got to pick a print book, which I think was quite, you know, I would have preferred to have a Braille book and gone home and have that leisure reading. And I wish that was encouraged, because when I did spelling tests, not only would I get away with contractions, but, you know, I would spell things phonetically because I wasn't seeing them in my daily life. And then when I was switched to a computer, it was, oh, spell check is a part of your accommodations, right? And sometimes you don't always have that. You know, you won't always have that available to you. And I think just kind of being dependent on that for me really, really took that away, because now as an English major, I really struggle with grammar and spelling.
Jenny, something that you point to really is the importance of a Braille-rich environment for all learners who are using Braille. And mm-hmm. when I mean Braille-rich, I don't just mean for the early childhood set, because, you know, we often talk about the need for a Braille or print rich environment for children who are first learning how to read. But I think it's important that that richness can carry on through the elementary and intermediate and senior years in school. Mm-hmm. Because then it provides the reader with the same opportunity for choice and flexibility that peers reading print will have as well.
Exactly.
You mentioned grammar and spelling, and I think those are two reasons why Braille is important, right? Like, listening to audiobooks is not going to necessarily teach you how to structure a sentence or
100%.
Certainly not how to spell anything.
Yeah, when I'm reading on the computer, you know, it's not telling me where commas are. It's not, you know, telling me how words are spelled, because it sounds so phonetic. When you're actually looking at a book in print, your eyes are scanning over words and, you know, you picture them in your head. When someone who is blind is running their fingers over Braille, you know, those words kind of become envisioned. So when sometimes I've even said, you know, I need to Braille out a word so I know how to spell it, because sighted people need to look so they know if a word looks right. Sometimes I need to do that to know if my word looks right.
Yeah, I didn't learn Braille until I was graduated from high school. My situation's a little unique. I should have learned it because I have a degenerative condition. And by the time I was 18, I couldn't read print anymore. But I sort of learned it through this college program on my own, pretty much just been, you know, given assignments. I didn't learn some of the rules like this contraction should not be used before that one and some of those specific things. But I have to say, like, learning it later, I can use it for labeling things and, you know, sort of give myself a few words to cue me on what I want to say if I'm doing a presentation. But I think the longest book I've read was when my son was two, you know, some of those board books, because I'm just so slow. So I definitely feel like something that's definitely easier to learn as a child. And I feel like the sooner you're introduced to it, the more natural it becomes, just part of your way of reading, right?
And, you know, Sean, but on that note, just have to reinforce that the really important thing, the important task of the early years is to learn to read, right? To acquire those core literacy skills. And then down the road, if we need to just map those literacy skills onto a different writing system, we can do that. The important task really is that literacy development piece. And then whichever writing system or whichever combination of writing system is going to best help that learner become a fluent, not only a fluent, but an engaged and happy reader, that's what we need.
You know, yeah, it's funny you say that, because I loved reading as a kid, and I was thankfully able to read with my eyes, only seeing a couple letters at a time until I was a teenager, and then the books got too long and the, you know, the print got smaller, but loved reading, like always had my nose in a book. And I know there are challenges for kids who do have some vision and maybe are going to lose their vision. Like, if you can see print, it's a heck of a lot easier probably to go that route. There's definitely more material available for you. Like, and then the motivation to learn the Braille when you can see the print, the motivation wouldn't really be there, right?
Right, right. And we do see that. We do see students who, you know, want to use their vision for as long, to the greatest extent possible and for as long as possible. And I think that, you know, your situation, Sean, kind of highlights the need for, you know, the need for us to put more tools in the toolbox rather than just moving from one tool to the next, because then we don't lose time and we don't lose opportunity. Because, you know, I'm sure that, you know, voracious reader Sean from, you know, the past would have definitely carried on if there were more tools in the toolbox, rather than going, you know, rather than winding down access to one medium entirely, right? And then spinning up access through another medium from scratch, not from scratch, but there's some form of continuity.
Yeah, thankfully I am an auditory learner and I enjoy audiobooks, and that's sort of been okay. I can still read like crazy, just in a different way. But yeah, it would have been cool to sort of have that skill all the way along and have the choice maybe. Jenny, do you have any cool Braille stories?
One cool story I have is that our high school didn't have Braille signage. And I was a part of lobbying for that signage, because the school board wasn't sure if they should produce it, because, you know, we are a minority and I'm going to leave the school in a couple years. But, you know, kind of reminding them that there will be people who come in and out of the school, as well as the school then becomes a more diverse and universally inclusive place. So I thought that was really cool, because I remember them coming to the school, putting up all the signs, and they're still there, because sometimes when I go to visit, I see them. So
let's talk about the Braille Challenge.
Oh, yeah.
What's the Braille Challenge, Adam?
Oh, wow. I'm so glad this came up. So the Braille Challenge is a Braille reading and writing competition that's held regionally and locally across Canada and the United States. And so students from all over the US and Canada participate. Some of them participate one-on-one with their teacher of students with visual impairments. Some attend regional events. And really what this is, it's a day of celebration. It's a celebration of Braille and what it means for students. And so I'm the regional coordinator of the British Columbia regional Braille Challenge. And I also serve as the Canadian representative on the board of the International Braille Challenge, which I'll explain what that is in a second. So the host institute, so the host agency is the Braille Institute that operates in Southern California. And when you're a regional event, you have students sign up. And then you get all kinds of different Braille materials sent. And then we have essentially a celebration. Well, it's a celebration with timed tests.
A competition as well, right?
A competition, yeah. And what it is, it's a great opportunity for students to not only connect with their peers who read and write in the same way that they do, but it's also an opportunity for them to kind of check their skills. You know, it's a competition. And so students participate from grades 1 through 12. They participate with the students in similar grade levels. And there's different competitions. So the younger grade levels, these students have spelling competitions. They have proofreading competitions. They have reading comprehension competitions. And then the older students, they don't do spelling with the older students. The older students have what's called speed and accuracy. And that's where they have to listen to a passage, an audio passage, and transcribe it. And then they also have charts and graphs where they answer questions related to tactile graphics and maps. And then in our British Columbia Challenge, we have a locally developed category that we do, and we call it the foundational category. The foundational category is for students who maybe aren't quite yet reading Braille at their grade level and who are perhaps working on more foundational goals, or students who are new to Braille reading entirely and still would like to participate. And so we create those materials specifically for those students and where they are with their Braille reading and writing. And so, yeah, everybody gets together. We've done it for 7 years now. It's great fun. And then the top 60 students across North America, 10 from each of the contest categories, are invited to Los Angeles for the International Braille Challenge, typically held in June of each year. Although this year's Braille Challenge was actually held virtually. And so students wrote in their, you know, at their homes and then sent their materials to Los Angeles to be graded. And then the final awards ceremony was online. It was actually a lot of fun.
So I actually never went to a Braille Challenge. I only went 1 year, which I'm so sad about because I feel like I really missed out on something. And I remember in grade 12, I entered last minute. I don't know if you remember that, Adam. And I was I'm just going to do this because, you know, I feel like I missed out on something. I was not prepared. I knew I wasn't good at my skills, but I wanted to do it anyway. And man, there is nothing like hearing a room full of clunky Perkins Braillers. Like, there's just gorgeous. Nothing like that in a bunch of bells. It was a lot of fun. Yeah. And, you know, I wish it was something I would have been able to do throughout school, but it was definitely a lot of fun.
Yeah, we always, and we're all, I should also point out that at every single event, all seven of them, Blind Beginnings has always been a great partner for us and doing activities and fun games and with all of our students while their materials are being graded.
So. Yeah, it's always a fun day.
Yeah.
So what is the plan for 2021's Braille Challenge then?
Great question. We're working on that right now. The committee is gathered and we are looking at doing some, we're going to be virtual. We know that. And we're hoping that we can have each contest category right at a different week, and then the contest category can get together at the end of that week. And then once we've got through all the categories, we'll get together for a big ceremony on Zoom at the end and have some games, and we can still send prizes in the mail.
Awesome.
Yeah.
So how fast can like a really strong Braille reader read compared to somebody reading print?
That's a great question, because I think one thing we have to recognize is that reading Braille with your fingers is not as efficient as compared to reading visually.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, I've known some pretty expert Braille readers who read at speeds that are quite comparable to kind of your average print reader. I think it's important to note that, you know, that also speed isn't everything. It's really comprehension and enjoyment of what you're reading that's most important. And it's also about having a lot of different tools in the toolbox, because, you know, it may be that for something you might just want to listen. Mm-hmm. It might be for other things that you might want to listen and read Braille. For some things, you just might want to read the Braille. And so having those tools in the toolbox puts the learner in the driver's seat, because they can then choose what works for them.
Yeah, that's one point about audiobooks. You know, your interpretation is definitely down to the reader. And when you're reading Braille, you can sort of, your imagination can take you anywhere, the tone that you're hearing things or, mm-hmm. yeah, changes, right?
Yeah.
There is definitely a misconception that Braille is becoming obsolete with talking, you know, accessible computers and phones and PDAs and all that kind of stuff. Like, why do we need Braille? What do you guys think?
Why don't we need Braille? you know, kids are still being taught to handwrite. Yes, there's more technology in schools, but I still think that the majority of kids are still writing out their assignments. You know, so why, if we're not taking away writing, are we taking away Braille?
Hmm. That's a great point, Ginny. And, you know, I would point to say that it's not only that we need just Braille, we need different types of Braille. We need hard copy Braille. We need refreshable Braille displays. We need multiple ways of accessing the Braille writing system. And, you know, I'll give you a perfect example of where we still absolutely need hard copy Braille. If I'm reading a science textbook and I've got all kinds of diagrams and charts and graphs, well, to get access to that material, rather than reading a long description of that material, I might want to access a tactile graphic. And, you know, right now in the marketplace, there aren't any refreshable tactile displays that are commonplace, you know, that we're going to find in schools, that we're going to find in libraries, that we're going to find in homes. And so there's still a need for hard copy Braille. And just in the same way that a student might want to read Harry Potter, let's say, on a refreshable Braille display, and have it just something they can tuck away in their pocket or their backpack.
Can you explain what a refreshable Braille display is?
Absolutely. So a refreshable Braille display is it's an array of pins, essentially. And the pins are mechanized and they're connected to a computer. And so the refreshable part is that the pins are lowered and raised based on the characters that are the words that have focus on the screen. So for example, for listeners who are familiar with, let's say, a Microsoft Word document, well, where the line that you have your cursor in on the display, on the visual display, is going to be the text of that line is going to be displayed in Braille on the refreshable display. And then when you move your cursor down to the next line, that Braille is going to change. It's going to refresh so that it reflects the line that the cursor's on.
That's pretty cool.
It's very cool. It's amazing technology. And they're traditionally, I mean, when the first refreshable Braille was one cell, it was just one Braille character at a time.
Wow.
And then the displays started getting longer and longer. And now you're actually starting to see multi-line displays that are coming available in the marketplace. So there's a lot of really cool developments happening here. And, you know, here's the thing. If Braille was obsolete, I guarantee you no one would be doing all of this research and development to design new refreshable Braille displays.
True.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I think the biggest thing for me is what Braille represents, right? Like it's on its own, it is an elegant arrangement of raised dots on its own. But it's the meaning that we give to it and the worlds that it opens up to our students that give it importance and give it meaning. And I think that's really what I like to take forward in my own work and what I like to try to impart to the teachers that I work with and the students that I work with, is really to be focused on the function and what Braille provides. And not to get hung up on, you know, things like how much space a Braille book takes up or, you know, not to get hung up all of the different devices that may be required to produce Braille, and to really just focus on what it brings to the learner and what it enables in the learning experience.
Now, if somebody was really interested in learning Braille just for kicks,
yeah.
I know Hadley School for the Blind has a course that's free. You can work at your own pace. They send you all the materials. And I mean, that's just sort of for your average person who maybe is curious about Braille. Somebody who's going to like produce Braille, there's a whole other course for that, right?
Yes, there's quite a rigorous course that someone would go through and then potentially also take a certification exam.
Mm-hmm. Right.
Yeah. But the interesting thing to see over the last decade has been the growth in online Braille training options, because in large part the English speaking world needed to all come together under one code. You know, prior to a decade ago in Canada, we used the same Braille code that was used in the U.S. But it was different from the code used in the United Kingdom. And so the English-speaking world came together over a period of time, it wasn't all at once, to unify under the use of one code so that if I produce a book here in Vancouver, a learner in Arizona could read that book, but also a learner in Nigeria or a learner in Ireland could read that same book. And there wouldn't be, code differences based on the region.
Yeah. And then we could have pen pals all over the world.
Absolutely.
For the first time ever.
Absolutely. So I'd encourage listeners to just look up Unified English Braille online. There's a lot of great options out there. Sean, you mentioned Hadley. That's probably one of our more kind of common go-to sources here in North America. But yeah, there's a lot out there and there's something for everyone. There's options for people who are just interested. There's options for parents who want to acquire a knowledge of Braille to be able to support their young learners or just any learner. And then there's more specialized training for teachers of students with visual impairments. And then there's even greater or more specialized training for people who would be responsible for producing Braille as part of their work. So those are Braillists or Braille transcribers. And for that, for those individuals, yes, there is quite a rigorous training program that I might not anticipate, I might not expect that someone who's just interested would take up.
Mm-hmm. Is there options for students who maybe want to improve their Braille skills?
If you look up Unified English Braille learning options online, there's lots of them. There's some very good ones from Australia, because Australia and New Zealand were some of the first English-speaking nations to really adopt this unified code. And so there's a really robust set of resources there. You mentioned the program at Vancouver Community College. And so I would encourage that, if there are any adults listening, to investigate what options might exist in their communities. Because learning Braille online is not for everyone. Some people need an instructor, whether that instructor is available via correspondence or there in person.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I think we need to start a Braille club and send letters back and forth to each other or something so we can practice.
I would love to do that, even though I'm like 20 years old.
That doesn't matter.
No, that's a great idea. That's a great idea, because then that also, not only are you doing that for yourselves, but it's also just a great model for young learners out there that, you know, literacy development in Braille is ongoing, and doesn't just stop because you graduate high school.
Exactly.
Well, thank you so much, Adam, for joining us. You are a wealth of information, and I'm sure that people are very much better educated now. We are going to do a part two Braille episode the first week of January, because that is when Louis Braille's birthday is, and Louis Braille was the person who invented Braille, where some Braille users are going to talk about what Braille means to them and their experiences learning Braille and all of that. But we wanted to talk to you first to kind of, you know, frame that and explain all the ins and outs of Braille. So thank you so much for being here.
Well, it's been my absolute pleasure, and I'm delighted to hear that you're centering user perspectives, because that's really key.
And thanks, Ginny, for co-hosting with me.
Yes, no problem. Thank you, Adam, and thank you, everyone.
You've been listening to Limitless, the Blind Beginnings podcast. If you have a question for us, please send us an email at limitless@blindbeginnings.ca. I'm your host, Sean Marcellet. Please join us next time.
For more information on Blind Beginnings and its mission to inspire and support children and youth who are blind or partially sighted and their families, visit www.blindbeginnings.ca.